The Reverend Danny Pegg is my latest guest in this series of nostalgia interviews. Now, I knew Danny about a decade ago when he was one of my students at the University of Kent. And Danny talks about how when he was a student, he had no faith. Theology was at the time for him something of an academic passion. But he talks about how a sudden experience led him towards a belief in God. He talks about it as a lightning bolt moment to explain his experience. We find out about Danny's family background. We find out that at the school he went to, he was one of only three white pupils in his class, and how he was exposed to Jainism and Judaism rather than Christianity when he was studying religious studies in school. We find out how for him faith is exotic. When he was a student, he was used to being around students who were mainly agnostic. We talk about the concept of the numinous, which is something that he encountered at Canterbury Cathedral. Now, he grew up in the heyday of pop at the time when the Spice Girls were everywhere, and we find out how Danny's parents' musical interests have left a mark on him. We talk about the secret cinema experience. We find out about the resurgence of both secular and religious pilgrimages in the world today. We find out about Danny's work on student and community radio, and whether he enjoyed listening to radio when he was growing up, and the nature of radio as confessional. And it's a very energetic interview. Danny talks at the end about whether his memories are predominantly positive, whether we can be nostalgic about negative experiences, whether he's still in touch with friends from his past, and what he means by the notion of walking backwards into the future. So, my name is Chris Deasy, and Danny Pegg is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Okay, well, I'm here with Danny Pegg. And in fact, Danny, I think, what's the title I should prefix your name with?
Well, if you were writing to me, it would be the Reverend Danny Pegg.
Well, yeah. Now, you were a student of mine a decade ago, and I most remember you from a course I ran called Death of God. But a lot has happened in that time.
Yes.
So, and I went to your ordination, of course, just a couple of months ago.
You did.
So tell me a little bit about the trajectory that you've been on.
Well, I think, I mean, when I was here at Kent, I did not have any faith. I wasn't from a religious family or anything. But for some reason, theology was always an academic passion. Literature and writing was my personal interest, but theology was always my academic passion. And I followed that through for a long time, and then I got some jobs after university and all of that. And then I had a pretty a sudden experience that changed my life, really, and that's when I started to believe in God and everything changed. And then very rapidly, just to give you an incredibly condensed version to start with, very rapidly after coming to faith, I realised that I was being called to give my whole life to it. And so I was ordained 2 months ago, but I've only been a Christian 6 years, something like that, and it takes a few years to train, so it's all been very quick.
Then again, you have politicians. In fact, there's one standing to be leader of the Conservative group in the Welsh Assembly, who it has come out has only been a member of the Tory party a few years and has voted for every other party in the past.
No,
she's found her path, but I think in your case, yeah, you're probably not going to start dabbling in that.
No.
This for you is obviously real and authentic,
but
you came to it maybe after a degree in theology, which I find fascinating because I've taught many students over the years who have needed to study theology as part of their ministerial training, but in your case you've got the degree and then subsequently you've gone down the path of ministerial and ordination training.
Yeah, that's right. I think for me the academic interest, it was almost like a fandom is the way I would describe it. It was a bit like just doing something that I like to do. So as if I was doing a Lord of the Rings module, I could just pick it up, enter into it, and then put it down is the key thing. Because having no active faith, it was like, well, if I was a Christian, I know what I would believe about the problem of evil, for example. But I don't have to worry about that. You know, I can have a debate, but then I can walk away from that. So the academic interest was almost like a fandom is the way I would describe it. I don't know why it interested me. Perhaps philosophy with an angle is how I would describe my interest there. And then I guess, I just carried on with that. And it took sort of my life having a bit of a downturn. I was in a bit of a tough place. A relationship ended, that sort of thing. And I decided that, if you remember me getting in touch with you, actually, this was at the same time that I was considering doing an MA and a PhD, and you had agreed to supervise that PhD. But I thought, well, I'm going into teaching. I'm going to teach theology, do what I was always going to do. And I thought, I need to go to a church to just scientifically examine what these people do. I had no idea. I've been to a wedding and a funeral, but I had no idea what they did. And with hindsight, of course, I don't view the fact that I was interested in doing that and going through a period of suffering as a coincidence. I now see those things as connected. But at the time, I thought of myself as just, oh, I'm just going to go and find out, like, purely academic. I'm not going to say any of the words of the service. I'm just going to go and see. And I went into a church. I picked an old one, so there'd be something nice for me to look at. I didn't think I was going to be interested in the service. I went in, sat down, and for me, it was a lightning bolt moment. I looked up at Jesus on the cross, and it was like he was real to me all of a sudden. I was crying. I was laughing. You can imagine these very well-to-do Anglicans sitting in their pews did not know what to do with me straight away, but very overcome. In the Acts of the Apostles, it says that the apostles are cut to the heart when the Spirit comes upon them, and maybe it's something like that, I don't know. But I had, let's say, I had this sudden experience, and I said every word of this service that I said I wasn't going to. I explored that, and I went away and I didn't tell anybody. It was absolutely terrifying. You know, what does this mean? Surely I'm not worthy of this. I've taken the mick out of this for so long. I've written essays decrying as to why this is nonsense, you know. I didn't tell anybody. And then the following week came by and Sunday was approaching, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to go. I couldn't stop thinking about it, and I went. And the curate there, she came up to me very intuitively after I thought I'd not been noticed because nobody spoke to me because, as I say, the laughing and the crying probably put people off. And she came up to me and she said, I didn't come up to you last week because it looked like you were having a bit of a moment, but I knew you'd be back this week, so I thought I'd come up to you now. And she welcomed me and I started going to this church, and it was several weeks before I told any of my family or friends, because it seemed like such an about turn, you know. But I got more involved in that church, and as I say, I was then confirmed, and I started helping out with services and the organisational side of things, and before I knew it, it just felt like, no, there's still something here. That vocational hole, you know, if you imagine one of those kids' toys with the blocks fitting the shape, it still wasn't quite fitting. This was righter than anything had ever been before, but there was more.
Mm.
And then my priest just said to me one day, we need to have a conversation, don't we? And he'd sussed it out.
It's interesting because my journey is the reverse of that.
Mm.
I used to go to an Anglican church in Wales assiduously on a Sunday. I used to help out. I would be involved in the communion. I was a server. But then I went to university to study theology and just assumed that I would carry on being involved in the university chapel.
Mm.
But I wasn't. And I think two reasons. The students who were involved in the chapel tended not to be religious studies or theology students, and those that went tended to be quite evangelical, so that wasn't mm-hmm. quite my natural habitat.
Sure.
But then I found, through studying theology, that I was able to delve into areas where I always felt very uncomfortable having a discussion with the priest. In fact, we had a female deacon.
Mm-hmm.
This was many years before women were even considered for
ordination. No, sure.
And I was doing a project. I was only in about third or fourth year at secondary school, so I was about 14, 15. And I asked the deacon if she had any particular thoughts on a project I was writing on whether women should be ordained, which was a very hypothetical issue in those days.
Mm.
And she was quite clearly a little bit upset. And I think her answer was more along the lines of, well, you know, why are you asking me this question? I thought, oh, I just thought that you would be an obvious, you know, thinking, well, one day I might be doing empirical research. No, and it clearly hit a nerve. And so that was probably around 1987.
Sure.
Okay. And I went to university and thought, I can ask all sorts of questions and nobody's going to tell me off for treading on sensitive territory.
Mm.
But you did the degree, and a very good degree at that, and then you had a different sort of journey. But we'll no doubt have, you know, much more to say about what you've been doing in the last few years. But just turning the clock back, first of all, tell me a little about when and where you were born, a little bit about your background.
Well, I was born in northwest London, in Northwick Park Hospital, is all I remember. I'm not sure where that exactly falls district-wise, but it was there. 1989. Technically, I was actually born, and I should have been registered as an American. My mother was American, and my parents weren't married, and she didn't have British citizenship. But nobody realised that in those days, so they just put me down as British. And I would have got that through my father anyway, but anyway. So that all happened. And I had a sort of... we all think our own experience is normal, don't we? But what I perceive as being quite an average upbringing at that time in London. So, I had parents that didn't have a lot of money, but the recent economic stuff under the leaders then had made it more easier to get on the housing market and things. So we had a house and we were doing okay. Big family, I have lots of sisters. And I went to school in a very diverse area. And it actually, ironically, you say we'll come back to those things because it all sort of links in that, you know, I was one of three white people in my class, and we had lots of huge diversity. And I remember doing religious studies in primary school, and we never very rarely often touched on Christianity because there didn't seem to be a need, because there weren't enough students who could contribute on those things. So we spoke about Jainism and Judaism and all sorts of other faiths, which was, I thought, was really enriching, and I really enjoyed being in a very diverse setting like that. So yes, and then it was all the way up until I was 13, until we moved to Sussex.
Again, the complete opposite of my experience. Mm. Church in Wales school, it was a church school predominantly white, I mean, almost exclusively white.
Sure, okay.
And we studied Christianity, and I think there was a little bit of controversy when the new GCSE curriculum came in, and rather than just study, as we did at A-level, of different books in the Old and New Testaments, mm-hmm. what we were doing was studying another religion beside Christianity. That was on the curriculum. We looked at Judaism, which was probably the safest sort of, you know, bet in those days. And you know, back then, that was unusual. The school had never really taught anything beyond Christianity, but the GCSE curriculum required a wider sense of religious faith and affiliation and background and culture.
Sure.
And fascinating that your experience on so many levels was very different, and it led you to religious studies at university.
Ironically, yes. And I think perhaps when I was in high school, I suppose religious studies was a burgeoning field. You know, comparative religion was newish, I guess. I don't really know, but I think it was. And that interest just stayed with me. I think because a factor would definitely have to be that there was lots of religion around me. And of course, I came from a family where you had your children baptized, well, christenings, again, that was the term we would be using, because it's what you do. You know, there was no home religion, but we're surrounded on all sides, in a sense, by different faiths. And I think that interested me. We had Jewish neighbours, I had Hindu classmates, and this was all very sharing. You know, we had school trips to temples and did all sorts of things. And I suppose that was a factor. I just have some very strange memories. Like, I remember as a 5 or 6 year old asking my mother if I could go to Sunday school, not really knowing why, and she didn't really know why either. And I think she said, if you keep asking me for a few weeks, then sure, but I want to make sure that you actually know what you're talking about. She probably wondered where I got the idea. I didn't obviously keep up asking, so I didn't go. But it was incredibly diverse. But I think that contributed, definitely.
Yeah, and would you say that was one of your earliest memories then, Sunday school?
Asking to go, yeah. I mean, I never actually got to go. But I remember asking to go as a very small child. And before that, I had only a handful of first school memories, really, before that. Not too many. That was early on. But again, I couldn't tell you where that impulse was coming from.
But I wonder, that urge to want to do something, even though you didn't... I mean, if you'd gone, maybe you would have been disappointed. You would have thought, oh, OK. But because you didn't, I wonder if it's sort of almost mythically set up this sort of idea that Sunday school is something that is... has a bit of the exotic about it, perhaps.
Mm, I suppose for me that the Christian faith certainly was more on the exotic side of things. It wasn't the everyday. It wasn't what I was experiencing. We didn't have a vicar who came in to do assemblies or anything like that in my school. I suppose that was the case. And then even going further, when I carried on studying that at GCSE and A-level, like you, at university, I wasn't studying alongside active believers until I really got to university. So I suppose that would play into it.
Did you feel when you were at university that there was much scope for talking about faith? Because you said yourself that you didn't have a faith at university. And as a lecturer, I'm very careful not to ask these sort of questions. I mean, in seminars, organically, students will volunteer information, mm-hmm. sometimes about their faith background or none. And a funny moment, maybe even in the class that you were in, where a student would prefix the answer to a question with, "I'm not religious, but..." And what obviously was meant in that context was, "I don't go to church." I knew that was what was meant, although it could be interpreted as a category of religion person. I saw that a whole new, you know, I thought I could write a paper on this. Mm-hmm. Indeed, I did. But in your case, did you find at university that it was okay to discuss these things? That, you know, talking about faith affiliation with other students, did many students feel comfortable about that? Or was it a sort of searching, sort of, you know, don't know, agnostic? My sense is that many of the students I've taught over the years, if they had to pigeonhole themselves, they would do so as agnostic.
I think that's right. And I think the majority of people that I knew would probably fall into that category. An interesting thing about my time here at university in terms of having conversations about faith, would be that actually I had quite a few people that had negative experiences of the Christian faith at university. I mean, Christian unions and free churches or Baptist churches that try to plant into universities are of a particular style, and you either like that kind of thing or you don't. And it often involves quite a lot of sharing of your life with your church family, and I see the boon of that. But from somebody who was not in religion at all at that point myself, I saw that as very invasive and very controlling. So I wasn't enamoured by those sorts of conversations that I had. But I think it was on the table. I think we could talk about it, which was good. And it wasn't as rare as one might have thought it was. It wasn't one person in 100 who had belief. You know, it was more than that. But I don't think I had any. I wouldn't say I had a friend who I now go to and say, you know, oh, isn't it funny, you know, you led me here or you were part of that. I don't think, you know, university friends didn't factor into it like that for me. But the city definitely did.
So the city? Mm. Yeah, go on.
For some reason, I volunteered to guide at Canterbury Cathedral while I was at university. And that was actually harder than it sounded, in that you had to wait to be on a night course that took 3 months that I did alongside my degree, to be allowed to wear a sash to tell people where Thomas à Becket was killed. You know, it was like that sort of thing. And when people would ask me why I was doing this, I think I would say that it was just something I did for myself, to have some time to myself, a reflective space. And I remember having several sort of numinous experiences in Canterbury Cathedral, most definitely. Nothing I would ever gesture towards being indicative of anything explicit to me, but just a feeling that this was right and I enjoyed being there. And I think, in regards to your previous question as well, I think that my studying of theology was very separate in my mind to lived experiences of faith that I'd seen, perhaps because the ones I'd grown up with weren't Christian, and my only interest theologically, I did have some interest in world religions and comparative religion, but most certainly my preference was Christian theology. And so I think that the people that I had experiences with at university who had a living Christian faith were so separate in my mind from the theological exploring I was doing and the biblical study and things like that, that it was definitely the academic side that was pushing me. And I remember when I left university and thought I was just going to work, I was only out of university for a very short time when I thought, oh, hang on, no, actually, I've got an academic urge here. Same thing happened when I did my A-levels. I didn't think I was going to come to university. And I was only out of it for 6 months and I went, oh, my goodness, I've got to go.
Mm. It's an interesting journey that a lot of people take, but it's one that you have to take on your own. Mm. Because if somebody had said, this is the path that is anointed for you. I mean, and it has happened with students I've taught who have admitted that they only went to university because of, for example, parental pressure. And guess what? By the end of the first year, they've dropped out.
Mm,
and I
exactly.
think in your case, you've had a fascinating trajectory, but it's one that is clearly one that you came to and arrived at, you know, that's authentically yours.
Yeah, I would say so. And I think for all of us in our vocations, whatever they may be, religious or otherwise, I think that there's an elastic band, and that elastic band can snap, as you say, with the people putting under parental pressure and being told that you are going to go and do this, and it just being so hard that eventually it breaks. But sometimes the elastic band snaps back, and I think for me it was a snap back, because you say nobody sort of ordained it for me. Well, actually, that did kind of happen. My A-level theology teacher was a retired Anglican priest who was very passionate about his job. For example, when the college tried to remove the A-level and we wouldn't have had enough to come here, he said, oh, well, if I have to, I'll teach you privately. You're not getting this education. But he told me at, I want to say I must have been 17, that I would be a waste to the world if I wasn't a priest. And I told him he was a silly old man. Mm. And he is very smug now and takes full credit for me. But he didn't push that. He said it, and then that was left with me. He wasn't hounding me week in, week out. And I studied theology with him for several years. You'd think if he viewed himself as needing to be an ardent evangelist, he had his opportunity, and he didn't. Maybe that was the right thing.
But sometimes these things do stick in your mind. I think back now to conversations I had, and it's, in some cases they're incidental. I mean, the best things are, aren't they? Incidental mm. conversations when somebody guides you without necessarily doing so consciously on a particular path. And guess what? You know, some of the other people I've interviewed as part of this series have found themselves as linguists, or indeed in one case as a priest, because of these almost random conversations, you know, in some cases maybe decades before they decided to embark on a certain course of action. But they realise that that conversation has resonated. And that is so important compared to a conversation where, you know, a parent might say, thou shalt learn the piano. And there's nothing more guaranteed to destroy a love or passion for music than being told that you have to play an instrument when you really don't have the talent.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah. But what about wider influences when you were young in terms of music interests, for example, or film? Because I know that was obviously, I taught you indeed on a course on religion and film, but would you say that music played a particular role when you were growing up? Anything that was in the charts, for example, at the time? Anything mm-hmm. that you sort of remember conversationally with fellow students in the playground and made you sort of almost defined a particular era of your life?
Sure. I think the music question is really interesting. I think unavoidably, being born in 1989 and then being a child in the 90s, it was pop's heyday. So I probably know more words to Spice Girls songs than I think I do, and all of that would fall into line. But interestingly, I didn't really follow it. I wasn't taping things off of the charts. I'm just old enough to have potentially taped things off of the radio. That didn't happen for me, and I wasn't a big CD buyer. But I do remember my parents' music quite a lot. That was almost, I mean, this is such a common thing, I'm sure. It is a big influence. My parents played a lot of Motown music and rock and roll music, and I think that stuck with me even now. I would have a Spotify playlist dedicated to that already. So that stuck with me.
Yeah, that certainly is my experience. I've mentioned this in some of the other interviews, that for me growing up, the twin almost... there wasn't a great crossover, but my parents' generation, sort of late 50s, early 60s, and then my own experience of growing up in the 1980s, mm-hmm. Has kind of, I wouldn't even say dovetailed over the years. It's almost as though they can be demarcated. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you might listen to a radio programme where the two go together. There might be a Lonnie Donegan song followed by something like the Human League, and I can identify with both. But one is what I've inherited from my parents, and, you know, seeing those 45 and 33 and a third, those LPs in a cupboard, yes. and thinking, you know, what is this, you know, and being told very carefully, you know, do not touch this, do not break this, this is, you know, potentially worth a lot of money. Whereas these days, because you can download it, it almost seems a bit dispensable, you know. It's the same, you know, yes. if you lose it, if you drop it, it doesn't matter, there's another one that you can download and it's relatively cheap. There was a certain mystique, a cachet about something, yes. like a record.
Well, I think I own more CDs now than I did when I was a teenager. I even own some records. I don't have a record player. I don't know why I own them. It's a collectible thing, I think, now, because there is this mystique about those things, that there are a few music items that I want to own physically, almost irrationally. I want to have them. I have played CDs. That does happen, but not that often, as you say, because you've got it digitally. But I think, as you were saying, that, you know, you could relate to both the older music and the music of your own growing up. I think what's interesting is that actually a lot of the music that was around when I was growing up that then I wasn't taking much notice of now almost has a renaissance with me, because you hear it now in specialist music programs or in specialist CDs or concerts or things that are done to a theme now. It almost groups it together. It's almost doing the work for me that I didn't have to do at the time.
But it was the same with me in film, that I didn't go to the cinema a lot. In fact, I really did not go at all when I was growing up. And all my friends were off to see Back to the Future and Indiana Jones, Ghostbusters. And I knew all the songs. So as soon as Ray Parker Jr. came on the radio, I knew it was the soundtrack for Ghostbusters. And then many years later, I saw the film Ghostbusters. And somehow it all made a lot more sense. And it's interesting that for me, and maybe part of the nostalgia project that I'm involved with, I would very often want then to go back to those films as an older person, say in my 20s, and think, OK, well, what was it about these films that my friends were talking about? And I could see these connections. And I felt in a way that I was fitting in those gaps, and those conversations that I couldn't have in the playground, I was now able to sort of delve into. And through my academic work, in a lot of cases, some of these films were able to play a role there. You know, it so happened I was working on Christology, so at one point Superman or Indiana Jones got a reference in mm-hmm. in my research. And in many cases, there was, you know, mentally I was nodding to some of those friends who were despairing of me at the time, that I would often say things like, oh, well, you know, I can't join you at the cinema on Sunday night because, of course, I write down the charts on Sunday.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
What I wanted to ask you, actually, you talk about almost filling in those gaps and going back to those things. Do you know about the secret cinema movement?
Oh, go on. It sounds very Gnostic.
So, well, doesn't it? Quite. It's nowhere near as mystic as that, I'm afraid. The secret cinema, I think they're a company. They I'm not sure how they started, but what they're doing now is making productions of films that are fully interactive, that involve a screening of the film. But you go 2 hours before the film's going to be on, and you have to dress up, and you're in the movie. They recreate the sets. You have to have interactions with character lookalikes. You delve fully in before watching the film. And this seems to be very, very popular among people sort of my age and older, but not really younger.
I did hear about this when they did it with Back to the Future,
yes,
in London in about 2014. And I thought at the time that in an age when things are veering towards the digital, although, as you mentioned, vinyl is on the way back, but at a time when everything seemed to be virtual and digital, having a material recreation so that you could, in the case of Back to the Future, as you say, before watching the film, you could have a 1950s haircut.
Exactly.
You could walk the streets and sit in the cars that were obviously part of this movie set, and they're obviously aesthetically and in a sort of postmodern context, you know, no one's saying that this was how the 1950s were, but it's the 1950s as realised through 1980s cinema. And for people growing up in the 1980s, then this film was, you know, in doing that and in partaking in it, then it very much is a rite of passage of sorts. It's almost maybe a form of pilgrimage.
Well, that's an interesting word to use for it, actually, pilgrimage, because it does seem that there is something else going on. Because with these secret cinema events, you could go, have a drink, buy some food from a themed vendor, and sit down and have a nice time and then watch the film. Or you could try and find the person who's playing Marty McFly and talk to him about something, and it will trigger a scene. They've done all this very well, and they've thought about it, and there's lots of different sets, and you can discover things. So there's something about not just revisiting but re-entering into that. And it's interesting you make the comment about it's the 50s as reimagined from an 80s point of view, because again, all of these things are through our eyes as children. I went to the Star Wars one. I went to Empire Strikes Back, and they very cleverly did all of the interactive stuff was A New Hope. So you did the first one and then you watched the sequel. It was very cleverly thought out. But I looked around, and when I was there, I remember seeing a lot of people who were A, getting very serious into the role-playing side of things, and were really leaving themselves at the door and having a nice experience of sort of disbelief. But also there were some people who were straddling a middle line. They weren't sure what they could and couldn't do. And it was clearly more about what they were comfortable with doing. And admittedly, role-playing is not everybody's thing, and it's certainly not something I've done very much at all. But it was interesting to see what happened when people experienced something that went off script, when they encountered something the actors were doing that wasn't in the film. So then now, again, we're in new territory. And it seemed to throw them in some way. It was very interesting.
And was it throwing the cast as well as the other participants?
No. It was very much the people who were in attendance. I think that the cast were trying to sandwich things together, get you from one thing to the other that you would recognise, but they had obviously thought out and fleshed out how they were going to do that. And clearly, for some people, not for all people, but they weren't looking to experience new. They were looking to experience what they knew and what they already were expecting to have.
Interesting, because there are two different types of nostalgia. There's the reflective nostalgia, which is the more analytical form whereby you, in many ways, see the disjuncture between where you are now and the past that you're remembering. And in many cases, that's why we use the word bittersweet. Then there's restorative nostalgia, which is the rebuilding of the past, and I guess in a way that's what Donald Trump is playing on with America, you know, making America great again, that sense of almost going back to a mythical golden age, but believing that it is something that is capable of being actualized, and it's using the past as a framework for saying, well, rather than look to a future that doesn't seem, that seems disorderly and chaotic and disruptive and very sort of like Pottersville in It's a Wonderful Life, you know, what we should be recreating then is Bedford Falls. And that is the slightly more dangerous one, because it's the one that really says if we rebuild the past and therefore perhaps separate ourselves from culture, we're not going to be contaminated by it. Very almost like Donatists, like going back to the early church, that sense of we don't like the direction the world is going in, therefore we will build this ark where you don't have all these apostates, and we, you know, we can be a pure community, the brethren, the community of the faithful. It has those elements, and yeah, I would find that very disturbing, because it also would perhaps convey to me that what I'm getting out of a film is something very different, and it's often about where you were at a particular point in time. And for me, memories of films, and I've gone back to watch films using different technology, Blu-ray, for example, or indeed going back to the cinema to watch films that I first saw 20 or 30 years ago. And in many respects, what comes back is not necessarily what's happening on the screen, but the memory of the people that I went with and what I'm missing, and that sense of community, and a community that maybe is no more because, other than through, say, Facebook, I'm not in touch with those people, and their presence is very much felt and lost, and that sense of displacement, which is very hard to convey in an environment where you have some Puritans who might then say, no, you can't do things that way because it's against the spirit or the letter of the film. So I find that I think I'd like to do one of those, but I think I would go in, perhaps rightly so, skeptically. Were there other films that have been done along these lines?
Yes, a friend of mine actually rather generously happened to secure some tickets and took me along to the most recent one they did, which was Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. And that was very different for me because that wasn't a film that I loved. It was a film I liked, and because I wasn't paying to go, I was more up for it. But it also didn't require as much inhabitation of a role or role play, because it was a very familiar setting. The film was updated, so it was a matter of putting on a Hawaiian shirt and walking down to Verona Beach and having a nice time. Whereas the Star Wars thing was naturally, just because of the mythic world, very, very different. And I had a good time. I didn't have an amazing time. And there were clearly people there who were having a much better time than I was, even though I was very happy. And again, that chimes so clearly with me, because with the Secret Cinema Project, it must be quite tricky for them to choose these films, because they've got to pick the things that lots of people are going to love. And not only that, but things they feel they can recreate and create an interesting experience for engaging with that. So no, I had a very different experience the second time around.
But imagine how that would work with Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge.
Oh, I think they did that. I think they did that.
18 only.
Yes, quite.
Actually, Christopher Partridge, who teaches in Lancaster, has done some work in secular pilgrimages, and an obvious example would be Graceland.
Oh, yes.
And this notion of hierophanies and sacred encounters. I've never been to Graceland, but I can imagine that if I was there, rather than necessarily think this is a sublime spiritual moment, I can imagine myself thinking, hang on, that person behind me is, you know, they want to push in front, or they're making a lot of noise, or God, you know, what am I having to pay for this? It's exorbitant prices. I can imagine that I'd find it very difficult to play that game. I think if something's happened organically, you can go to a film and maybe think, well, I don't know if it's my cup of tea, and just think, actually, this has really appealed. Whereas sometimes, if you try and engineer something, the chances are you're probably going to be a little bit, not so much disappointed, but there might be a disparity between the expectation and the reality, and you have to then process that. And you can only really process that after the event using reflection. But that sounds just amazing.
It was. And actually, it's interesting that you talk about the secular pilgrimage thing, because that certainly is seeing a big resurgence. I found a business the other day that are creating them. You know, they're just making new ones up because people want to do it, and that's a lovely thing. But interestingly, in the Christian world, at least in my experience in this country, there's a resurgence of pilgrimage for us too. I think people are rediscovering ancient ways that people used to walk or travel in some way, and re-injecting that reimagining that for the contemporary religious worldview.
Yeah. And just saying something more about your time at university, mm-hmm. You did religious studies with comparative literature, is that right?
That's right.
And what about other things that were going on when you were at university? Did you follow through some of the musical or the film interests? We've covered religion here. Obviously, you were studying religion, but the personal faith came later. Politics, for example, was there anything going on at university that particularly stands out in terms of what inspired you and which perhaps moved you in a different direction to some of the influences that you had when you were at school?
That's interesting. I think it was definitely the creative things that inspired me and pushed me forward here, as opposed to perhaps more activist things. I was never involved with student campaigning or societies at all in a big way. But what I did get involved with was the student radio station. And I also, with a very close friend of mine, founded a theatre company while we were here. So we were simultaneously creating our own stuff over there with that, and then shepherding other people to create content on the radio, both of which I really, really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, I'm so jealous. well, of course, now that I'm now doing what I should have done many years ago. This is my own radio show.
Ah, there we are.
But oh, fascinating. So what were you doing? Were you playing music? Was it very speech-based?
Well, I started as a speech content presenter. So I did a show with my friend on a for a programme that only had to have four or five songs an hour, so it was mostly talking. And I dare say it was inane and terrible when I look back now, but it was a lot of fun at the time. And because we were the radio station here is a community radio station as well as a student radio station, so you would have people write in, and you would have people say, you haven't told us about the traffic, you know, like normal radio things. So I think that sort of put an immediate vice on us, a sort of a pressure on us that... we had to deliver this content properly. So he very quickly, my other friend, got involved with the running of the radio station. And I took over as running the speech department. So then I was helping other people create radio plays, quiz shows, and occasionally presenting stuff myself as well. And it was a very, very different creative outlet to making theatre or writing plays. And what was interesting about doing the radio is that I'm not normally somebody, he says with a dog collar on, standing up in a pulpit most Sundays, not somebody who likes to stand up in front of people and do that. I like to be behind the scenes. And I think radio was a perfect combination. I was invisible, my voice was heard, but I wasn't up front. And with the theatre stuff, for example, I will never, ever tread the boards. That will not happen. Luckily for me, ministerially, that's different. I can do that. But with the creative stuff, it was the creating that I liked.
So the thing about radio sometimes is that you can be... in a very bustling environment, there's a lot going on, it's very noisy, there's cacophony, but you can then sometimes just step back, have the radio on, and be taken somewhere where it's where you want to be. John Donne, I remember on Radio 2, for years was very avuncular. He was very softly spoken, and he used to do the drive time programme on the radio, and I imagine that people would be commuting, they'd be at radio, you know, railway stations, they were living very busy lives. And he'd be the voice of calm and reason, the antithesis of what was going on in their daily grind. And I think the rise of Zoo Radio is, I think, awful in a way, because you then have almost a replication on the radio programme of what is going on. You know, Chris Evans, we just learned this week, is now going to be leaving the Radio 2 Breakfast Show. It's a fine programme, but it's almost as though he's replicating in the studio what is going on in people's homes and people's kitchens, whereas Terry Wogan, who preceded him... was almost sort of saying, well, you know, we won't talk about social media. We won't talk about the busy world out there. This is our own community. And I think it's that alterity, that disjuncture, which I think gives radio something, makes it very special. And it's just one person with a microphone and the things that you can get up to, rather than it being as rehearsed as TV tends to be. I think it's amazing. Were you a radio listener yourself?
It really took being involved in radio for me to even consider listening to it. I was not as a child or as a teenager. As I say, I wasn't taping the songs off the charts. But I think I've been much more open to it now. And I would say that in the last sort of 5-10 years, maybe this is just my narrow view, but I'm led to believe that, I mean, radio drama has had a sort of quite a renaissance, especially with the likes of things like Doctor Who and all those things being played on mainstream radio stations now. But I think it's what you say about the radio presenter is really interesting, because it's something about relationship. I think listening to a voice talking to you, it cannot not feel personal. And I think that's why you're saying, you know, how it can suddenly create calm for people. It can create a sense of safety or a stepping outside of the day in the world. That makes perfect sense. And it's interesting. I remember a friend telling me, who's a much more advanced in years and has been a minister for a long time. He was saying that when they started to record their sermons and have them available for listening at later times, they would get more hits on their sermons very quickly than they even had people sitting in the pews. People were listening to those who weren't even coming to their church. But it's a different way of hearing anything. So it's not just particular to religion. But I think it's a personal thing to have somebody talking to you in any setting. But if you've got them in your ears and only you can hear them, it's almost more private.
Yeah. Sarah Kennedy always used to say that, well, I don't know if she actually said it or this was ascribed to her, but in speaking on the radio, she used to do the Dawn Patrol 5 in the morning. She was imagining one listener and she was speaking to them, and she did that for many years. And of course, if you have a community of people who think that they are the only person being spoken to, it's like the Morecambe and Wise gag, isn't it, about what about the other viewer, what's he doing? But it's true, because you feel this special connection. Of course, it can go the wrong way, and you see that Clint Eastwood film, for example, Play Misty for Me, when somebody thinks, he's talking to me, that presenter is, you know, I've fallen in love with him, and maybe, you know, he's reading out my dedication. We have this special bond. But radio cultivates that in a way that it's the most intimate. It is a form of confessional, I would venture.
Oh, yeah, no, I would absolutely go with that. I mean, it's not uncommon to hear radio presenters telling you stories about how the reason why they jammed on a song all of a sudden is because they had a call from somebody who said something really urgent or pastoral or very personal. I think people feel able to do that, absolutely.
Yeah. A few philosophical questions to wrap up. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones when you look back, you survey your life?
Yes, I would, I think. I mean, I've been very lucky and very privileged. So in that sense that I haven't had any significant upheaval. My parents haven't divorced. And I haven't had that sort of experience. And whilst we come from sort of working class background, I've never, ever experienced any serious poverty or anything like that. And so I think that, yes, I think I choose to remember the better times. That's a very interesting question. I'm going to stop there, but
yeah. What about? I mean, do you think you can be nostalgic about negative experiences?
I think absolutely, and surely relationships would be the peak thing, the obvious thing to go to, in that you hold those things together, even if they are a paradox. You're simultaneously happy to remember, you know, that moment on that bridge, that song, even if you know how this goes, or if even in that very memory, in that moment, something also bad happened. We can hold them together.
And I think sometimes it's possible to imagine relationships that you didn't have, or, you know, the idea of a relationship that didn't happen. I mean, it's Dante, isn't it? Dante,
oh, yes.
And Beatrice. Mm-hmm. That sense of the relationship that, you know, if he'd married Beatrice, if she hadn't died and they'd had a relationship, well, you know, I don't know if she would have been his muse. She was his muse precisely because she represented all the sort of values that he wasn't really finding as he was growing up. And the childhood sweetheart scenario, I guess inevitably some people might find that they fell in love with their childhood sweetheart and then married them and they were together forever. But that isn't the narrative that many people tend to hold. But bittersweet, certainly.
Absolutely. And you're right. Say that, you know, Beatrice wouldn't have been his muse in that way, because how we choose to remember changes us now. And so I think that it's not even just imagining relationships that didn't exist, but choosing to remember relationships a certain way and building on that hagiographically. I think we all do that.
Would you say that you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, which I ask is an interesting question, because of course in your case you certainly wouldn't have anticipated, other than perhaps your A-level teacher who thought that there was a particular calling that you yourself didn't see in those days. But as you look back, and obviously you're still relatively young, but very young, but do you find that maybe you're not doing what you thought you were going to do? Do you still hanker for something that in the fullness of time you think might be realised?
I think for me, I had always had things that I wanted, and the difference between then and now is that I think I found what I am and what I'm supposed to be and what quite literally God has put me on this earth for. Prior to that, you know, I wrote, I was creative in that way, and I wanted to utilize that. I wanted to experience those things and have that outlet, and I still do have that outlet. But I think my thoughts when I was younger about those things were just that simple urge response, in the sense that I enjoy doing them, I want to do them, what pathway do I carve out that allows me to do them? And there's something about self-actualization there which speaks to the current trends in our wider culture, about the fact that we're just told that you can be anything you want to be, you know, conditions they choose to conveniently not mention, you know, all the different factors that can affect people's lives that are beyond their control, and all that matters is your true self, your inner self, and if you can make that real, you've achieved something. But I think that's a narrative.
And would you say that you're still in touch with some of the friends from your, and of course in your case it's relatively recent past, and you are very much I would say a social media generation, would you say?
Yes, I would. Yeah. And I do keep in touch with people. I think I have the ability to pick relationships up when, for no reason of our own, just because of the way the world is and busyness gets in the way, you haven't seen each other in a long time. But I think I do like to make that effort. And actually, it's almost more rewarding, I think, sometimes. When I was ordained, I had a very unusual collection of people come together, people that I think probably weren't even expecting to be invited, but came and got to meet me now and meet friends and see how we've all changed and also just meet because they would never have met any other way. And I think, I really quite enjoy doing that, actually. And I try and keep relationships going in that sense. I've got friends living all over the world that I try and maintain that. But sometimes, you know, these things fall by the wayside. There's no reason why you can't pick them back up again.
Yeah. No, I mean, my experience of Facebook is that I've only been on Facebook for less than a year now. But the opportunity to reconnect with people, but to do so in a way that then can precipitate those real world encounters. So it's, you know, you meet them virtually, but then the opportunity to meet up physically. And what I've been struck by is how easy it has been to carry on from where we left off 20 or 30 years earlier. In some cases, you realise that, yeah, we've all aged a little bit. We perhaps look a little bit older and more haggard and browbeaten, but we are authentically the same people. And I think I went through many years of often wondering, where is so-and-so these days? And it's very, you know, very hard. I suppose you can go through, there was a period, I think, you know, maybe the best way was to go through electoral registers or phone books, but you'd have to be really dead keen to meet a particular person to do that. And that's almost, you know, going down the extreme path that you really want to meet a particular person. Whereas these days you can come across them on social media. It can work both ways, of course. Sometimes you can encounter people and you realise that sometimes that they weren't maybe the best of friends then, and you realise why maybe those connections weren't worth cultivating.
Absolutely. And I think we're back to secret cinema in a sense. If we were talking about things being a gateway into memories and nostalgia, surely the finding of these people and meeting them, you're not just meeting them, you're meeting the whole world that you both shared and knew. And I think that's why people on the whole are quite able and willing to pick up where we left off and make it work. I don't hear too many stories of friends saying, oh, I met my friend who I've not seen in 10 years and it was really awkward and we couldn't talk. That doesn't tend to happen, because if you've got to the stage where you want to meet them, you're investing. And I think that part of that, whether we subconsciously think it or not, is that it takes us back to the us of then and the them of then, as well as the them of now, and we want to get to know them and continue now. It's not just using them as a means to get back to our memories. But I think that there's a pleasure in sharing those things together and reopening those doors and getting together and doing that, definitely.
And I think it's interesting that in my case, I've put a lot of myself out on social media. No doubt, you know, lots of eccentricities, but it's a way of, you know, video posts as well. So in a way, before those meetings, I think a lot of people hopefully have found almost the assurance that, you know, they know what they're going to get. And of course, in some cases, they might say, sorry, Chris, I'm really busy. But, you know, thankfully that hasn't happened too often. But anyone listening to this might think, Right. Final question. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
That's really interesting. I think I would say I'm a looking forward kind of person. On the one hand, I think that's Christianity's nature. There's something about the hope that we're offered in that keeps us looking forwards. But I think that just socially speaking, looking forwards is not at the exclusion of the past, I think. And I think I was talking to somebody today and they used the metaphor of, if you're looking into the past, then you must be walking backwards into the future. You're almost completely ignoring that because you're only looking in one way. And I think that when I say I'm a looking forward sort of person, I like to dig in the bag occasionally though and look at the things I'm bringing with me and obviously incorporate the past in that. But you want to do more, you know, even when it is in the example you're using about meeting up with an old friend, it's, you wouldn't just want to meet up with them and recount memories literally and then go home. That isn't enough. You want to do more and take things forward and see what's coming. So I think looking forward.
Brilliant. It has been so wonderful to catch up with you again.
It's a pleasure.
Reverend Danny Pegg, thank you very much.